Alice L. Houston. Justice Frydenberg is recused from this matter, and he is also recused from the last case of the day, which is State v. Rashad Washington. Mr. Norlinger, good morning to you.
Good morning, Justice. May it please the court, justices, and the chief justice. My name is Tim Norlinger. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, Dallas Houston. This is the third time that Mr. Houston's case has come before this court. The first time was on a direct appeal. He was represented by substitute counsel that was different than trial counsel. He was represented at trial up until sentencing by John Jorgensen, who's with the Lancaster Public Defender's Office. After the conviction but before sentencing, Mr. Jorgensen was discharged, and Jeff Pickens was appointed to handle the sentencing and the direct appeal. As part of that direct appeal, Mr. Pickens made various allegations with regard to his conviction for second-degree murder, including that trial counsel failed to object to certain exhibits or that the court erred in allowing certain exhibits to be put into evidence. Those exhibits are 38, 81, and 95. This court in the direct appeal stated that because Houston did not object properly to Exhibits 38, 81, and 95, or any alleged inadmissible statements contained therein when they were offered at trial, any evidentiary error that resulted from admitting those three exhibits was not preserved for appeal. The court then, in that same direct appeal, went on to state that Houston's trial counsel may have consciously chose as part of trial strategy not to object to the evidence identified on appeal. Therefore, because the record's insufficient to adequately review Houston's claims of ineffective assistance of counsel, we do not reach those claims on appeal. So the issues with regard to these three exhibits was unresolved by the direct appeal. Mr. Houston then timely filed a motion for post-conviction relief in front of the trial court pursuant to Section 29-3001. Judge Colburn denied him a hearing. He had made a number of allegations, and those were then appealed again to this court.
Part of the district court's reasoning in this post-conviction order essentially quarreled with this court's determination about whether the objection had been preserved. The state has specifically argued that they're not going that way. What's your position?
I believe that the issue has been decided, and I was going to quote some language from the court's second opinion to you with regard to that issue. And I believe if you look at the second opinion where the hearing was granted, this court says it is settled that the trial counsel failed to object to the admission of the exhibits 38, 81, and 95 as was required to preserve a challenge, and based on our determination that Houston has made sufficient allegations, and then it goes on. So I would suggest that the trial court was incorrect in finding that the record was sufficient to show that the trial counsel properly objected.
Part of the basis for the trial court's determination in that regard was that there was the motion in limine objection was made at the beginning of trial, and then a standing objection was requested, and the trial court allowed that standing objection. And it cites some cases where it contends this court has previously said that is sufficient to preserve the issue for appeal.
That's true.
Do you quarrel with that, or do you just quarrel with where that leads?
Well, I quarrel with that because I think this court's reached that issue by saying that Houston did not properly object to 38, 81, and 95 at the time of direct appeal. It's in that opinion. So therefore, I think it's settled that this court has reviewed the record before it, the Bill of Exceptions, which included that standing objection. The court found that the statement, no further objection at the time of the offer, was not sufficient. So I believe that Mr. Houston's never really had a chance to have the court address the underlying exhibits at issue, which he quarrels with. So
is there any indication that Mr. Houston's direct appeal counsel brought to this court's attention the request for a standing objection?
Yes, there is. In fact, if you look back at the briefs that Mr. Pickens wrote, he made an argument that
38, 81, and 95 were improperly admitted. And then he laid out, delineated why they were improperly admitted. And then he also made an alternative argument in that same brief saying, if the court deems the objections not to be sufficient, it was ineffective by Mr. Jorgensen at the time of trial. So that issue was presented to this court in Pickens's brief. I didn't listen to the oral argument, but I can tell you that both the reply and the original appellant's brief on the direct appeal covered both. With regard to the specific exhibits at issue in this case, Exhibit 38 is an interview of Mr. Houston on September 16, 2009, which includes a discussion about an open sexual relationship that's homosexual in nature between himself, the decedent in the murder, and also other individuals. That was extremely prejudicial in my view of reviewing the record. Certainly, it doesn't appear to be relevant to the ultimate issue of the second degree murder, and it serves both no real relevant purpose with regard to it.
Could you respond to the district court's findings that it would have been admissible because it was relevant to, I believe the district court mentioned motive and possibly bias?
I think that is, I respect Judge Colvin a lot. I find that argument to be somewhat specious, frankly. I think that when you look at the nexus of these events in this case, the real issue is whether or not the decedent died as a result of a suicide or was killed by the appellant in this case. If you look at what the forensic pathologist even said at the time that he evaluated the decedent, the issue was raised that but for the statements of the defendant, it would have been impossible to figure out what had happened. I do not believe that the sexual relationship or the open sexual relationship that existed has any relevance as to motive, and I think it's incredibly prejudicial. So I would disagree with the trial court on that. With regard to Exhibit 81, that is an interview of the defendant on October 8, 2009. In that interview, the main investigating officer, Investigative Sorensen, provides numerous statements to Mr. Houston that were asked to be redacted, indicating this is not a suicide, this is a homicide, stating it as fact. During the course of that interview, Mr. Houston denies that on multiple occasions, but he is overridden again and again by one of the main investigators with regard to this case, where he also opines, and Sorensen states, you're, quote, killing him. Exhibit 95 has similar discussion, and that's an interview that occurs 2 days later on October 10, 2009, between Mr. Houston and Investigator Sorensen. The appellant again denies that he murdered this individual, that's the decedent, that was his boyfriend, and Sorensen reiterates, it is murder, you've killed him. And then in addition to that, Sorensen makes a statement about Mr. Houston being a, quote, serial killer, which is incredibly prejudicial, especially when you're dealing with a case where someone is accused of second-degree murder.
Doesn't Mr. Houston himself in those conversations entertain the notion that he might be a serial killer?
He does, but it's only after the suggestions made with regard to that by Investigator Sorensen.
And couldn't the investigators' statements be received not for the truth of the matter asserted, but for context of the questioning of Houston?
Well, I would state that whole exchange should be excluded both for prejudice and for relevance. And certainly not relevant. There's no allegation that Mr. Houston is a serial killer, has been involved in multiple murders. And we are talking about a jury trial where jurors are asked, having to decide whether or not a murder occurred, whether or not my client was the one that committed it, and an investigating officer with more information than they may have in the course of a courtroom is referring to serial killer. With regard to the ultimate issue in this case, as this court is aware, this ultimately comes down to the Strickland v. Washington standards. I believe this court's opinions, both in the direct appeal and in the appeal granting the hearing, show that counsel was deficient in his performance by failing to properly object to these exhibits. So the remaining issue is one of prejudice. Certainly, I believe that the statements by Sorensen were prejudicial to Mr. Houston in this case. I've cited a number of cases, McCabe, McKinney, Bierman, Doan, Welch. I would point out State v. Jacob. It's found at 242 Nebraska 186, where a shooting victim was allowed to identify an individual in a murder case. It was found to be hearsay. It was remanded for a further proceeding. In addition to that, I would ask the court to look at Bierman and Doan, which are cited in my brief. Those both involve improper bolstering of child sex victims by essentially having the state offer in deputies or psychologists as credible witnesses.
Before your time completely expires,
sure.
Our opinion in the first Houston case, does it not, after discussing each of the pieces of evidence which were found to not properly be preserved, didn't it observe that there was other evidence not objected to but also not raised on appeal, similar in nature to each of the categories of evidence at issue?
There are, this case is certainly complex. I would concede that. And there are, in addition to the exhibits that are at issue on this post-conviction relief, a number of other statements made by my client, Mr. Houston, both to individuals wearing wires and other statements made to law enforcement. They are not all the same. They are different. And I would also point out that when you look at everything, the appellant clearly is going back and forth between what he's saying in these statements. It contradicts itself when you look at it at various points. He testified at trial that he did not commit this murder. And then layered in with that, additionally, is this comment about being a serial killer and this open homosexual relationship that appeared to be prejudicial and attacking the character of the appellant that could have prejudiced him in front of the jury.
Is that to say there are other items of evidence that have some of these phrases to which you object?
There are other statements by the appellant which could be deemed admissions that were not objected to. I do not believe the open sexual relationship nor the exchange with regard to serial killer, in my recollection, is.
Just to be clear, not objected to at trial and not at issue in this post-conviction proceeding.
Correct. That would be correct. Yeah. There, my recollection is counting there were about 10 interviews with the appellant. So certainly a lot of that did come in and it was not objected to. And by the time I got the case, it had not been raised.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Faust, good morning to you.
Counsel, my name is Stacey Faust, Assistant Attorney General, representing the Appalachian State of Nebraska. As counsel noted, this case is back before the court after an evidentiary hearing on Houston's sole claim that his trial counsel was ineffective for failing to object, at least for purposes of appellate, for preserving for appellate review to Exhibits 38, 81, and 95. The state agrees with the district court that Houston did not meet his burden to show that his trial counsel's performance was deficient or that trial counsel's alleged deficient performance prejudiced Houston. To begin, I think it's especially important to the deficient performance analysis to note that in Houston 1, this court first discussed why a motion to redact is a more specific form of a motion in limine, and so that a movement must object to the specific evidence sought to be excluded when it is offered at trial in order to preserve error for appellate review. Trial counsel did not have the benefit of this court's analysis in Houston 1. And the failure to anticipate a change in existing law is not deficient performance.
Was that a change in existing law?
I think so. I mean, this court noted in Houston 1 that it was a case of first impression for them to determine what exactly was needed on a motion to redact. Secondly, I think it's very important to the deficient performance analysis to remember the trial counsel is given due deference to formulate trial strategy, and there is a strong presumption that counsel acted reasonably. This court in Houston 1 again highlighted that precedent. Here, trial counsel John Jorgensen testified strongly about his reasons for failing to make more detailed objections at trial. He explained, and the district court made very clear in its order, that there was no confusion below about the grounds for Jorgensen's objections, primarily because of the exhaustive manner in which the motion to redact and the objections were discussed between the parties and the court.
But Mr. Jorgensen thought he was preserving the issue for appeal, did he not? And so,
he does believe that.
And can we find that to be a reasonable strategic decision when he believes that he's preserving the issue for appeal, but we later found that he did not.
I don't think it necessarily goes to preservation. I think the reason those facts are so important is for the deficient performance analysis and being there in the moment when he knows that the court knows exactly what his objections are, what the grounds for them are, so that he knows any further objections are going to be unsuccessful. He's not going to highlight that testimony further. He's not going to go any further in his actions because he knows it's not going to mean anything.
But he also had the belief that he'd done enough already.
He did. He did.
And so can we say that that's a reasonable strategic decision if the strategy is, I'm not going to object it when the evidence is offered because I think I've already preserved it, well, when that's incorrect?
He had additional reasons besides that, was that he did not want to highlight to the jury this testimony when he knew his objections were going to be unsuccessful. And he also didn't want to negate any defense credibility that they had built up already at that point when he knew his objections were going to be repeatedly overruled because this evidence was multiple statements for multiple grounds. He was going to have to needlessly objecting repeatedly. And that was another reason. That's reasonable trial strategy, to defend, to uphold your credibility in front of the jury and to not be highlighting testimony over and over again in front of the jury that you know you're going to be unsuccessful on your objections for.
Is there a tension between that strategy and our rule-based and continued jurisprudence requiring objection at the time of admission?
No, I don't think so. I mean, this court, as I said, intimated in Houston 1 that that is a reasonable trial strategy. Like, that even though that may be the law, if you know you're going to be, if your objection is going to be overruled, why highlight it for the jury and bring it to the court, to the jury's attention, if you know that your objection is going to be unsuccessful? I don't think they're opposed to one another. Knowing the law and knowing that you're going to lose, so I'm not going to highlight that objectionable test. That's also necessary.
Well, assuming that the principal reason that we adhere to requiring the separate objection at the time that the evidence is offered is to give the trial judge the very last opportunity to make the correct decision and reverse an erroneous motion in limine decision, isn't there a little bit of tension by saying, well, they cannot have to do it because they don't want to highlight their objections?
I suppose there may be a little bit of a tension. However, both are rooted in this court's jurisprudence. And especially on the facts of this case, I think it's very important to note that the district court has come out in its order and been very clear that it was not confused and that it was not going to reverse its ruling. So actually, Mr. Jorgensen was correct. All he would have been doing was highlighting the testimony for the jury, and it was going to be a lot because it was multiple statements by Mr. Houston that he would have been having to object to on multiple grounds.
Well, he would have been highlighting it, but he also would have been preserving it for appeal. And isn't that the whole issue that we're deciding now in post-conviction?
Well, I think it's already a foregone conclusion because of this court's previous opinions that he didn't preserve it. Now it's, did he have reasonable trial strategy to not be objecting as he should have to preserve it? I think it is a separate question now. We are under the umbrella of Strickland, and it's a harder burden to meet.
Can you point to any authority where a court has said that it is not deficient performance or it is a reasonable trial strategy for a lawyer to not object, believing that they have preserved the issue for appeal, but when they are, in fact, incorrect about that belief? So this would be something new, as far as you know.
For that question, but I think it still falls within the jurisprudence of not wanting to highlight the testimony. I mean, Jorgensen's deposition testimony was also to that effect. I knew I was going to lose. I'm not going to highlight that and destroy any credibility with the jury that I had gained by that point to make these needless objections and to be overruled repeatedly. And even if this court disagrees with me, there is no deficient performance. There's no probability, let alone a reasonable probability, that but for his alleged deficient performance, that Houston was going to be acquitted. Just to illustrate, here's what the jury watched and heard from Houston. September 16th, he stated that Johnson committed suicide. He found Johnson with his face wrapped in cellophane and his body wrapped inside of a blanket. Then on September 29th, Houston's multiple personalities emerged. And Q, one of his personalities, explains, oh, it must have been a nightmare, because Vincent, his other evil personality, wrapped cellophane around Johnson's face a second time after Johnson removed it once and asked him to stop. And then Q showed the officers a mock death performance, or Houston pretended to kill Johnson, suffocate him with a pillow. And then you have his statements to his friends that his evil personality, Vincent, admitted to wrapping the plastic wrap around Johnson's face, during which time Johnson yelled, "Get it off," holding a pillow over Johnson's face when Johnson broke through the plastic wrap while trying to breathe, and then listening to Johnson's last heartbeats with enjoyment. And then on October 7th, you have Houston telling officers that he had a recurring dream that Vincent suffocated Johnson with a pillow after Johnson broke through the cellophane while trying to breathe, but Houston had no choice but to face that he physically did it. And then he also admitted that he wrote suicide letters from Johnson to Wilson and his other friend Nick, who later gave the letters to law enforcement. And then on October 8th, he retracts his confession, claiming that Vincent was just torturing him with this dream. And later in the same interview, he admits he had a suicide pact with Johnson. He claimed that in effort to keep his promise to Johnson, he put a pillow over his face after Johnson opened his mouth in what Houston believed to be a reflex. And then he listened to his last heartbeats before he called 911. And then he gets up at trial and he says, "Just kidding. That was all a social experiment. I don't have multiple personalities." He also conveniently could not remember if he wrote the suicide letters. He then returned to his initial statement that Johnson committed suicide and he had absolutely nothing to do with it. May I continue to finish out my argument?
You may wrap it up.
Thank you. Houston got himself convicted because he would not stop talking. The jury heard him tell lie after lie after lie. I think I said the exact same thing during his direct appeal, and I'll say it again. No juror was ever going to believe that Johnson committed suicide after hearing and watching all of that from Houston. His credibility was zero. He was done. And therefore, we ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? Okay, that takes us to the next case of the day, and that is